Okay, I will open today's hearing of the meeting of the House Veterans and Emergency Services Committee. And I will open, first of all, a public hearing on House Bill 2177.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2177 permits Department of Veterans Affairs to receive monetary and non-monetary grants, donations, and gifts. Permits department to sell or convert non-monetary grants, donations, and gifts to monies when sale or conversion is not inconsistent with purpose or limitation specified in grant, donation, or gift, and to use monies to carry out duties under law. Declares emergency effective on passage.
Mr. Wallace, Mr. Mann, or whomever, whatever combination we have here. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Willis. I'm Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and I'm here today in support of House Bill 2177, which is an agency housekeeping bill drafted to allow the Department of Veterans Affairs to dispose of non-monetary assets at the discretion of the director. Under current statute, non-monetary gifts received by the department must be converted to cash if the gift cannot be used directly by the department. Non-monetary gifts with no value and not useful to the department can be given to people, corporations, or organizations that serve veterans. Under current law, however, the department cannot give these gifts directly to needy veterans, their survivors, or dependents. House Bill 2177 will allow the director, on his own authority, the discretion to provide non-monetary gifts with or without value to needy veterans, their survivors, and dependents, or entities serving veterans. The bill maintains the current process for converting non-monetary gifts to cash should the director determine that such conversion is the most appropriate disposal of the gift. House Bill 2177 is intended to provide the director more flexibility in providing non-monetary gifts such as wheelchairs, clothing, toiletries, and other items directly to needy veterans and those serving veterans. The department sees this bill as a simple housekeeping measure and knows of no opposition to the bill. I might point out, as we sit here today speaking on this bill, I have three electric wheelchairs, two in very nearly new condition that could be, were this bill the law, given to a needy veteran directly from the Department of Veterans Affairs for their use. However, under the current law, I'd have to find an agency that would be willing to take that electric wheelchair and somehow funnel it to that needy veteran. This is not only true of things like wheelchairs, but something as simple as a walker or a pair of crutches, those kinds of things that people are willing to give us to help veterans. So, as I said before, this is a simple housekeeping cleaning measure, and I'd be happy to answer any questions the committee may have about this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, how did we ever get here?
Yeah.
I mean, why would we pass legislation to prohibit this in the first place?
This, Representative Esquivel and Chair Cowan and members of the committee, this actually predates my knowledge of working with the department, which did not begin until the year 2000, and this statute was already in place. I can only think that the reason for such a statute in other places that I've worked or been involved with is simply to maintain control and integrity and auditing and risk management and that kind of thing. I think that the department were, hopefully, when this bill passes, has a responsibility of keeping records, which we do, as to where did we get the gift, what did we do with it. And that's all part of our department audit structure that happens every year. We're audited several times a year for several different reasons, including what I would call in this case excess or donated property. I have no problem with that. I'm happy to be audited. But what I need is a method to streamline the ability to get this to the people who need it when they need it. And currently my hands are pretty much tied. And then if I have to sell the item, then we would simply put the money in one of our trust funds and have it available for those folks who might need our services with some kind of a cash expenditure. But I'd much prefer to take the item in and match the need. So that's the reason for the bill, and I'm happy to answer any of the questions.
Thank you, Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair Cowan. It's more of a comment. Hear, hear. High time. We do this in schools all the time, and it is. It's just a disposition of your product, just like you just said. And whatever you need to help get this done, let's do it.
Thank you, Representative Kump. I appreciate that.
Representative Wider.
Are these? Thank you, Madam Chair. Jim, just a question, because I guess I'll be the devil's advocate here a little bit. What's the monetary value on some of these items? I mean, how high can they go? Can these be $50,000 items? I mean, can there be new cars that are equipped? That's where I can see this law being enacted, is because of things like that being given away and maybe to someone who didn't really need it to. Because we trust, as much as I trust you, it's who comes after you.
Yes.
May not be of the same level of integrity, if you know what I mean.
Well, Representative Widner and Chair Cowan, members of the committee, let me just tell you, there is a threshold that's already in statute for items such as this, and if you exceed $5,000, now you've got to go through the Department of Administrative Services. So the $50,000 donation, which I'd happily take if someone wanted to give us, I couldn't deal with it independently if I wanted to, because it's statutorily protected above $5,000. And most of the items we get are less than that. Pair of crutches, as I said before, a walker, specialized breathing devices that we get sometimes for people who have to use oxygen. We get a number of different kinds of wheelchairs. That happens fairly frequently. On occasion, we'll get a wheelchair-equipped van. And the way we deal with that now, which will answer hopefully what Representative Escobar was getting at, we won't even take such a donation because there's too much to go through to make it worthwhile. So what we do, and we have, I see our representative from the Paralyzed Veterans is here, and he can tell you on more than one occasion, we've called the Paralyzed Veterans of America, the Oregon chapter, and said, we have a person that wants to donate a wheelchair access van. It's in good shape. It's ready to go to help some paralyzed veteran. Will you people please take care of this for us? And then we don't even get involved in it. And they've done a great job, by the way, of helping us in that area. So we're, you know, where there's a way, we'll find it to do this. But in terms of the current statute, I think we're well protected. All right.
I have a question just to make sure that we're clarifying everything. When you talk about one of your options is organizations that serve veterans, so can you pass things along to, looking at my agenda, maybe the American Legion or an organization like that?
We can do
that. You have that current statute.
Under the current statute, we can do that, and we have done those kinds of things.
But then you would have to select, in follow-up, a particular geographic location. You're looking for the option that if someone contacts you with a need and you have it, you might be able to make a direct connection.
We can make a direct connection, and in many cases, again, because it's a direct service organization to veterans, we will donate these things to the Oregon Veterans Home, which even though it's a subsidiary of our agency, it is a standalone in terms that it's contracted to operate it. And so we'll often have a senior veteran at the home that needs mobility help, and we can transfer that mobile wheelchair to that person, and they can use it in the veterans' home. And that makes sense.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Any other questions? Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this bill? Because I don't see any, and it really appears to be a simple housekeeping bill, in my opinion, and since we were advertised as a possible work session, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2177 and open a work session on House Bill 2177.
Madam Chair.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we move House Bill 2177 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, could you call the roll, please?
Okay. Representative Boone?
Aye.
Esquivel?
Aye.
Pomp?
Aye.
Riley?
Aye.
Wagner?
Aye.
Freeman?
Aye.
Matthews?
Aye.
Collins?
Aye. Thank you. House Bill 2177 passes unanimously with a due pass recommendation, which I think qualifies it for the consent calendar. Is there any objection to our suggestion that this just simply go to the consent calendar?
Yes.
All right, there we go. Now we'll open a hearing on House Bill 2164.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2164 expands subtraction from taxable income for compensation to member of Armed Forces of the United States, applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2009.
Thank you. Paul Evans and General Caldwell. I am requesting that you come forward and put this into English so that we can figure out what this bill is actually talking about. Oh, this isn't the one that I was so confused about. This one's a somewhat simpler one. There's another one. You really do have to work on the English.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brigadier General Mike Caldwell. I'm the Deputy Director at the Military Department. Pleasure to be here today, and I guess we could steal a line out of Director Willis's testimony that this is housekeeping. And it may seem more than that from its from your first blush, but it truly is a housekeeping issue. And let me explain the history of this particular item, and I know that you're going to have a subsequent referral. In the 2005 session of the legislature increased for the first time since 1971, I might add, the deductibility of military pay for Oregon income tax for approximately whatever the number of years that was in 71, the income tax was deductible amount was $3,000. The legislature increased it to $6,000, and subsequently, we of course put out to our membership and all Guard and reservists and all military members that we could reach that the state of Oregon had seen fit to give them an additional deduction. There was some discussion during those hearings about what did this really mean, because there are several different methods of taxation throughout the military. For instance, if you are on federal active duty or you're on in what we call Title 32 status, which is under the control of the governor for the Guard, and you are doing your duty out of the state of Oregon, we do training in Washington, Idaho, Gownfield, Idaho, Fort Lewis, Washington, Yakima, California, or perhaps any place else in the United States, that income that you receive is non-taxable in the state of Oregon. So is if you're brought on federal active duty for any purpose and you are deployed either to another post on the continental United States or you're deployed to a theater of combat or any place else, that income is non-taxable in the state of Oregon. However, if you are on federal active duty, whether it be active service, guard, or reserve, and you are doing your duty in the state of Oregon, say, for instance, a recruiter, and your home of record is the state of Oregon, then that income is taxable. Most people don't choose to have Oregon as their home of record, and you have that option when you're in the military. You can actually be from Oregon, but select your home of record as wherever you're located. For instance, Fort Riley, Kansas. Most people prefer Texas because they don't tax the military, period. And if you're stationed at Fort Hood, Texas, you can make that your home of record. Then you can be deployed to Oregon as a recruiter, and your home of record is still in Texas, so therefore you avoid the taxation. Well, the legislature, I think, wisely decided that, you know, since 1971, it's been a $3,000 deduction, and upping it to $6,000 is probably something that they could afford to do and should do. So they did that. Well, then came the implementation.
As the implementation began, it became evident that based on the status that the Department of Revenue or the definition that the Department of Revenue was using to determine which type of duties were exempt or fell under this $6,000, I think that we had a definite differences of opinion between people that sponsored the bill, which is the Oregon War Veterans Association, those of us that testified and those of us believed what had happened during that session, which was that included all weekend drills and annual training pay. The Department of Revenue said no, based on the federal guidelines and based on their tradition that they had used, which I'm not questioning that they were legally sound. I would suggest to you that they were legally sound based on what we've always done. But they believed that the way the law was written, it wasn't clear, so therefore, since it wasn't clear, you could only deduct those pays that were earned during annual training, 2 weeks in the summer traditionally, which meant that all the drill pay that you would get was not deductible. Well, to put it in total context, so you really understand what we're dealing with, we have, since the wars began, the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, we, the National Guard, have used a multitude of different pots of money to pay people to prepare them to go to war. Under that construct of the Department of Revenue, have we used the right kind of money, it would have been deductible. If we used the wrong kind of money, then it wasn't deductible. So we suddenly became having to be fiscal law slash income tax accountants as we looked at the impacts against our soldiers, because perhaps we choose to use Title 32 dollars and we didn't have access to Title 10 dollars, therefore taxation occurred. We had several meetings with the director of the Department of Revenue. I think they were extremely accommodating, trying to get to where we needed to be, where we thought we were when we left the 2005 session, it was the 2007 session. And they were trying very hard to get to where we thought we were going to be, and they said, we need a bill that clarifies this. We will make a temporary rule to get where we think we all wanted to be, but we've got to have clarifying language in the ORS and the statute in order for this, for us to feel safe that we've done the proper thing. So they did a temporary rule, and they said, we're going to accept the 2008 taxes under that guise and let people deduct it, but we've got to come to you to get this thing cleaned up and get it fixed. The last thing I'll tell you about this is that when we did the numbers, we calculated the numbers, had we kept up with inflation from 1971, the deduction would be somewhere around $14,000 today, if we just kept up with the 1971 deduction versus up to today. What the Department of Revenue found out in their investigation was it wasn't 71 when this was enacted. It was actually 1951 when the legislature decided to give $3,000 deduction to military members. One last thing, I forgot this item. The other problem that we had with definitions was this. Under the current statutory language and the way the Department of Revenue had to interpret it based on case law, based on federal law, everything else, in essence what would have occurred was the National Guardsmen who do drills and annual trainings would have been punished because versus the reserve component, because the U.S. Army Reserve now doesn't use the term weekend drills, they use the term battle assemblies. So in essence, they could say, we do battle assemblies, you guys do drills, we can deduct our money, you can't. So getting out of the Pentagon terminology and legalese, we were trying to craft legislative language that simply made it wide enough that they could fit inside of it and get to the objective, which is to give this deduction to men and women who serve either in the active component or the Guard and Reserve. And I will stop there and leave it up to my trusted governor's representative, Mr. Evans, to add anything I missed.
Chair Callen, members of the committee, for the record, I am Paul Evans, policy advisor to Governor Kungoski for military emergency management and veterans issues. And I want to basically begin with kind of a paraphrasing Churchill, two great cultures separated by a common language. That is, in fact, the Department of Defense at times where terms get in the way of common sense. The most important aspect when reviewing this bill, and there's really four points I want to raise. I second everything that the General talked about. I also want to emphasize some points that I think, quite frankly, are more important than any of the potential revenue discussions or other things. We're sending 3,000 kids out the door this spring. You've heard that. You're going to continue to hear that. This issue needs to be resolved before they go. One less thing having to do with taxes and the home front on their mind really will be important. Whichever way you go, we need it settled. That's just a request that we have, because we don't want the troops and the families confused on that issue. The second is that truly since 1951, as we found through this process, though, again, I want to commend publicly, I want to commend Department of Revenue for working with us on this. It was one of those things where everybody's sitting around the room thinking that the word meant the same thing, and we realized that everybody wasn't thinking that the word meant the same thing. Active service, the working definition of active service, has fundamentally changed since 1951. It was never conceived that the National Guard or Reserves would become an operational component of a total force. It was just never conceived. And one of the things that I think is a misnomer is that just focusing on the active duty pay, which had been the consistent definition for some time, assumes that people are just ready to go to serve on Title X status. As those familiar with semi-professional volunteer activities, or at least certainly organizations like the National Guard and Reserve that are part full-time folks, part-time folks, you have to do a lot of prep before you're ready to answer the bell. And active service, the term we believe is really what is intended in the spirit, if not the actual black and white letter of past interpretations. That active service component is what allows us to answer during a flood, during fires, during storm season. It's what allows us to put young men and women, and some of us not so young men and women, into harm's way when necessary. It really is hard to say that active service only means active duty anymore. And what we're asking for in this case is, at this moment in time, now that we've all recognized the problem, that we try to fix it. And again, in this particular session, I know finances are on everybody's mind. The third point I want to raise is that right now, well, most likely you're going to get a revenue discussion or revenue worksheet that says X number of people in the service getting this particular benefit equals X amount or Y amount. The fact of the matter is that officers and senior NCOs already deduct that because we do enough Title X, or at least enough federal duty as it is. The folks that we're really concerned about right now are the E1s through E6s, the enlisted folks that right now aren't able to do it. And they're the families often on the edge that need help. So the fiscal in this particular case, I have no doubt everybody's doing the best they can with the information they have to make sure that they're following the protocols in place. But the practical truth is that of the 8,500 National Guardsmen, for example, in Oregon, several thousand already are deducting it legitimately under the current definition. It's the younger folks, the folks that are certainly the ones that we're more concerned about coming in and coming out of this deployment, that it will most affect. So that's really the points I wanted to raise. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I certainly will try to answer any questions you might have.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see that this says, as used, this active service includes, and a list of things. Does it include fighting fires? Does it include...
Madam Chairman, Representative Riley, it does not. Those happen under state control, under state active duty. So that income that soldiers receive for that is taxable inside the state of Oregon.
Chair Cowan, Representative Riley, but it does include the time spent on drill status that help build skills that can be used during times of fire. That's the piece we're trying to tie into.
Okay.
And also, I think we'll use Katrina as an example. We initially went to Katrina under state active duty. It was converted to Title 32, which in our case means that you're under the control of the governor, mm-hmm. you're paid for by the feds. The other reserve components do not have U.S. Code Title 32. It's only for the National Guard. So they're always under Title 10. And we tried to do that initially with some other workings with the Department of Revenue. Say, well, if you're leaving the control of the governor to go into the federal active duty, you make a change in status. It's really simple to define that. Well, then we realized that the reserve components didn't have the Title 32 and weren't under it, so therefore that didn't work. So we tried several different things. The other thing I'll mention is that And part of the confusion, if you look under here, summer camp, well, that's an old term. We don't use that term anymore.
Right.
We use annual training as a term. So it's no longer a germane term, however people sometimes use that term just in almost slang to us. We also use, instead of battle assemblies, which we're probably going to be going to that term, we use the term inactive duty training, IDT. That's an old term from the Cold War era. So it's very easy to see how Department of Revenue certainly would have seen this as really clear-cut. Inactive duty training means weekend drills, therefore, simple. So we're trying to cover the water here with everything, but like I said, even as we write the bill, terms change.
Right. As a follow-up. And that was my next question is, you know, these are very specific terms. They're jargon, if you will. We know that jargon changes over the years, and isn't there some way we could write this so that we didn't have to worry about jargon changes?
Madam Chair, Representative Riley, I've been doing this now as of Saturday on the state's birthday, 38 years. And 38 years ago, it was summer camp.
Right.
We all went. And I have seen more term changes, and I suppose if I was a very good lawyer, I might be able to come up with wide enough language to handle that. But I, like I said, we had some certified smart people in the room, and this is kind of what we came up with to try to get across as wide a front as we could.
Final one, if I may.
Final.
Thank you. I'm very much in support of this bill, and I plan to vote for it as is. I'd like to see at some point something that covers everything without specifically naming each, because it gets us into this. We're going to come back and
be at it again. Yeah,
be at it again. And okay.
Ask the certified smart lawyers if there's a better catchphrase we could put in there that covers a wider front.
Thank you.
I'll get to that. Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Have you had a chance to look at Texas's bill, since it appears that Texas is the best at this?
Madam Chair, Representative Widner, with respect to taxation in general?
Yeah, or the bill that they have drafted to cover their employee, because it looks like we're just asking for $6,000 and they just exempt them all the way through all active duty.
Madam Chair, Representative Widner, indeed, what I've learned over the years, I have not looked at that language. What I've learned over the years is that people prefer certain states for home records, and Texas is the number one. If you look at even some of the corporation that I know, or association that Paul and I get our insurance in under, is called USAA, and it's in Houston, not in Houston, but in San Antonio, Texas. So the military definitely has a big footprint and a wide berth. I think Oregon, if you look at Oregon from, there's only a few states, I think there's five or six in the country, that have about the same level of military activity as we do. We're really, really, we're in like 97, 98 as far as number of military dollars come in, because the National Guard is really the only game in town. Most states have more military footprint. So when you look at it in that context, I suspect that Oregon hasn't really thought it was necessary to make adjustments to accommodate that. So I would guess that's part of the history in it. But I never looked at it verbatim, but I know very well from the jail, or what we call the barracks lawyers, they all know where the tax write-offs are and where to be.
Yeah. Well, that's looking at this and what we're doing. I still don't see why anybody would want to say their home state's Oregon, because we're not solving the problem and we're not giving incentive for the military to come here.
Chair Cowan, Representative Widener, I one thing about the active duty piece is that when you are Title 10 active duty full-time, you get to choose whatever state. In this particular case, these folks are for the most part, residents of Oregon, so they can't choose to, I mean, they could move, but they couldn't live here and choose another residency. Texas also has some other benefits for being a resident other than just income. And in specific case of this bill, because of the financial climate we're in, we know we're asking a lot just to get this, and we don't want to be seen pushing too hard. The reason we're here, quite frankly, is because as an officer, doesn't affect me, but it does affect my kids. And if I'm sending young ones across the pond, I want to make sure that it's at least simple for them. And because the Department of Revenue did put that rule in place at our request, I want to make sure that there's no confusion for the folks going out the door. But certainly we will look at the Texas bill and come back with maybe some better suggestions at a better economic climate.
So if I can try to make sure that I'm summing up what I think we understand here. And first of all, this is a subtraction, not a deduction. Is that correct? This isn't a deduction.
Madam Chair, it is not a credit. It's a deduction off of your taxable income.
It's a subtraction. Is the way the bill reads, it's a subtraction from your taxable income, and I think that's an important clarification.
That's correct.
Okay. It's income that doesn't count in your income. It's not a deduction that you take.
That's correct. You lower your state tax taxable income by $6,000.
Right.
And it's three more than you do now.
Its intention is to simply make sure that basically all of the activities of the Guard and Reserve in terms of the various drills that are necessary, that income that they receive is included with, is subject to the $6,000.
And Madam Chair, as Paul indicated, what I think is also important is that particularly the what we call field grade officers, which is Major, Lieutenant Colonel, Colonel and General, those positions are going to earn far more than that $6,000. They're going to earn probably on an average guardsman in those categories are going to probably have an annual income traditionally without all of the other activity $12,000 to $18,000 a year, just somewhere in that neighborhood. So it will assist them as well, but not to the degree it will for the youngsters who are typically going to make $6,000 or $7,000. And we even question how many of them will actually have taxable income. And we're not even sure a lot of them that this is really going to impact will ultimately end up having taxable income to begin with. So there is a debate internally with the certified smart accountants trying to figure that out. So,
understood. I think maybe that's an important piece of clarification then, because, Paul, when you were talking about it basically applies to E1s through E6s, that this is already allowed for administrative kinds of roles.
Madam Chair, what I was trying to say is that the current interpretation of active service, meaning active duty, a lot of us already meet that requirement as it is. So there's no change for us. The change, which is for the positive, is that with the change in, or at least the expansion of the definition, it will include more of the money that arguably should be to make sure that the enlisted guys and gals have that same benefit. That's really what we're trying to make sure of.
Okay. I understand the point that an individual who makes less will be more impacted by this amount of money than one who makes more.
Right.
But the other piece of it is there are those who already meet the qualifications, and this is to try to be inclusive of those whose job descriptions might not put them under this category. Is that correct?
Job descriptions, experience, and yes, ma'am.
Whatever you
well,
ask.
And also,
okay.
The individual doesn't get a choice on where they serve their duty.
Okay.
So, if for instance, our battalions in Eastern Oregon all do their annual trainings in Boise, Idaho. All of that is, they don't have to claim that. But the units that are on the west side of the state pretty much do their training at Camp Riley or other places that we direct. So now, if you're a member of the 41st Brigade, you pay the tax for annual training. If you're a member of the 116th Brigade in Eastern Oregon, you don't.
So. Okay. There was a suggestion that we try to come up with language that's more all-inclusive and less specific. Do you want to tackle that as an amendment process?
I think we should go ahead with what we have, Madam Chair.
Just thought I'd be sure here. Okay.
I was thinking of that for the future.
Okay. All right.
That'd be a discussion we could have in revenue.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was thinking about if this happened in 1951 with $3,000, when I was in the service in 1967, as an E1, I made $90 a month. So I'm thinking, what was our real big repair on this thing? Because you wouldn't have attained that even close back in those days. So we've really gone backwards, actually.
Madam Chairman, Representative Escobar, I would argue that in 1951 they said basically we want to make all military pay exempt.
Right. That's exactly what they did. They just did it with a number.
They just did it with a number, and they made it so high that nobody hit the threshold. So whatever military pay you got, no matter what service you were in, what status you were in, was exempt. Now, I will tell you in about an hour, I'm going to go over here down the hall, and I'm going to testify to your colleagues on the Ways and Means Committee, and I'm going to tell them what a good bargain we are, because we're paying $35 million annually, or biannually, in a biennium, into the coffers of the state of Oregon in income tax from full-time primarily, but part-time and full-time wages. We're asking $20 million out. So we're a $15 million cash cow to the state of Oregon. Good deal for the state of Oregon. I don't know if it's going to get me any credits down the hall, but we'd certainly like to use it as a positive situation for the Guard being in this state and doing what we do. Aside from that, I would contend that you're absolutely correct that those legislators in 1951 believed that it should be exempt. I don't think that's the case now, and I'm not sure that I would argue for that. I still think that even though we earn money, particularly our full-time force, in those days the full-time force was probably 150 for the whole state, if that. We now have a full-time workforce, works every day in the state of Oregon, approximately 2,700 people. So, I think there is, we should pay taxes as a contribution to our state, because we, even part-time, full-time. But I think this specific exclusion is a positive thing, and it ought to be, because it's going to cover a wider range of people.
Well, this is very specific to this particular subtraction. I think I'll ask, is there anyone else who wanted to testify on this issue? I will close the public hearing. I'm basically wrestling with whether to open a work session, because this does have a subsequent referral to revenue where some of these details are going to need to be worked out. All right. I will open the work session on House Bill 2164.
Madam Chair.
Representative Riley, who's down there kind of begging me to do it.
Yes.
Make the motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we move House Bill 2164 to the House with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to revenue.
Is there any further discussion? We have the clerk call the roll, please.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Escobar?
Aye.
Kahn?
Aye.
Riley?
Aye.
Whitener?
Aye.
Freeman?
Aye.
Matthews?
Aye.
Kahn?
Aye. House Bill 2164 passes unanimously with the due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to revenue, where I am assuming you folks will try to explain all of these numbers to folks who need to work that out. Thank you.
I'll be there.
Representative Riley will take care of that for us over there. All right, we'll move now to a public hearing on HJM 3. I believe this is the one that I was talking about. It needs English translation. So, whoever wishes to tell the one with the big book, will tackle that. Good. I think that you did. Mr. Molina, you're working on explaining that. Maybe you can put that in the short form for us here.
Madam Chair, members of the Committee, House Joint Memorial 3 urges Congress to increase funding and eligibility for fee basis payments for veterans and to review and simplify fee basis statutes and regulations regarding payment eligibility for specialty and emergency health care for veterans.
Mr. Willis.
Chair Cowan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. This is simply a reference manual. This is not my testimony. So I want to make sure everybody understands that. This is a copy of the federal laws, rules, and regulations that govern the services that are provided to veterans. And the key issue, before I get into the actual testimony on this, is what in the world is fee basis payments? What is that all about? Well, let me just tell you in layman's language what it means. It means that those veterans who have qualified through United States Code 38 and section specifically 1703, can, if a VA facility is not available to them, or if the VA facility is what is called on diversion, meaning they're full and can take no other patients, the VA can then authorize this veteran to seek treatment or up to and including an operation, if necessary, in their local community, and the VA will pay for it. Now, this is critical in states that have large rural communities. So let's pick out a place like Burns, where a veteran may need to be transported to Bend for some kind of procedure, and that person is a service-connected disabled veteran, and there is no room for that person for this operation in Roseburg. There's no room in Portland. There's no room in Walla Walla, and yet they need this medical procedure. The VA, through the fee basis program, can contract, if you will, with the local hospital in Bend. This veteran can be treated, recover, and return to their home in Burns, and the VA will pay for it. That's the short explanation of what fee basis is about. However, what HJM 3 is asking through this body of the United States Congress is to simplify the rules associated with using fee basis, especially by rural veterans, and the availability of the care itself being in the area closest to where the veteran lives, and make sure these rules are easy and clearer to understand. Now, let me put an even finer point on it by telling you this. This weekend, I attended a meeting of the State Veterans of Foreign Wars. A veteran approached me at that meeting who lives in Sutherland. Now, Sutherland is only 10 miles north of Roseburg, where the Roseburg VA Hospital is. This is a service-connected disabled veteran who found that he had an emergency at home and needed to be treated. However, having dealt with the federal VA on a number of occasions, he was smart enough to call ahead and say, I'm coming down and I've got some medical problems, I need to see a doctor right away. They, quote, the Roseburg VA Hospital told him, we are not able to see you right now. You must go to Mercy Medical Center, which is, of course, the large medical center there in Roseburg. He assumed that meant the VA knows I have a problem, it's connected to my disability, and they have told me, we can't take care of you, you need to go to the local medical center. That's exactly what he did, and oh, by the way, he did it by ambulance. That's the kind of condition he was in. Well, of course, he ended up with a multi-thousand-dollar bill for that treatment, and the VA said, well, we didn't authorize fee basis for your treatment. We simply told you we couldn't treat you right now, and you needed to go to the civilian hospital. What we need is to simplify through Congress and through the funding through the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs a way to say to that veteran, we are authorizing your treatment because we can't treat you, even though we should. We can't. We either don't have the doctors, or we don't have the rooms, or we don't have the emergency room ready, or we can't put you in an operating theater right now to do an operation. So your fee basis number is C123456. That's the number you need to use when you put in for payment of the bill for this diversion where we've sent you to a civilian hospital. And now the veteran has permission from the VA to seek this local treatment. Now, if it's in a non-emergency situation and they still are not able to travel the long distance to a VA facility, they still could get that number, which the closest thing I know to describe it would be a confirmation at a motel. When you make a reservation, they're going to give you a confirmation number. In this case, when we seek treatment, even diagnostics or x-rays, they give you that number, and now you know that the VA is going to pay for that when you get it done in beautiful downtown Lakeview, which is where you live. as opposed to trying to find a way to get to Roseburg, which, by the way, by the time you're transported and by the time somebody pays for your stay and you get back home, is more expensive than getting it done fee-based in your hometown. So the purpose of HJM 3 is to send that message from, excuse me, from this body to the United States Congress, and then through one of our delegation champions, either on the House or Senate side, we'll seek to introduce federal legislation that does funding of the fee basis program at an appropriate level and simplifies this particular section of 38 United States Code, Section 1703, which, oh, by the way, has got 21 separate sections that a veteran would have to know and understand before they could use this fee basis program. This has got to be simpler. I know it. We can make it easier and better for the veteran. So I hope, Madam Chair, that that explains the fee basis program and why we want to streamline it and simplify it and fund it at an appropriate level so that those veterans in our rural and suburban areas can get better and quicker, faster, and more efficient treatment.
I think I need to offer a comment that if it is this difficult for you to explain the problem, it's obvious that there is a problem.
Madam Chair, I have to agree 100% with what you just said. It is a problem.
And
it needs to be fixed.
For clarification, I think what I've heard you say is basically there's two times when this comes into play. One might be when a reasonably nearby veterans facility is full or don't have available operating rooms or for whatever reason don't feel that they can provide the treatment in a timely enough manner. The other really relates to geographically the remoteness of an eligible veteran's place of residence. And so are there two separate approval processes that one goes through? I mean, you're getting the approval for one of two different reasons.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there may be a number of different reasons why you are seeking this medical care. But the approval process is pretty germane across the board in terms of getting approval, whether it's an emergency or a service-connected ailment or the need to do diagnostics based on, you know you're sick, you just don't know what's wrong with you. And the bottom line is the facility that would normally do that can't see you, and you can't wait. So where do you go? Well, we need this to be paid for by the VA, and we need it to be very simply done. That's all there is to it.
Madam Chair, there has been, members of the committee, there has been a little bit of work done in terms of emergency care that's reimbursable. There's been some movement on that. But the overarching issue is that there's not enough capacity in the VA system at this point to treat people that are currently in the system in a way that is efficient and in sometimes some ways effective. The fee basis argument has to do with recognizing that really the VA has three choices that they need to do. And if I could kind of begin my comments
Please.
At that point, what we are trying to do, because you've seen two other memorials pushed through here, and they're all part of a strategic approach to push the VA into publicly acknowledging the capacity issue needs to be resolved, especially with remote and rural veterans. One memorial had to do with saying that full funding of the VA system as a whole, and full funding not just the money for the current folks there, but a no-kidding, soup-to-nuts full approach for VA funding, so the capacity is good and available. The other end of that spectrum has to do with transportation, that we have to rethink how veterans are getting to and from the hospitals, either make care more available in the locals or make the transportation system getting to and from those facilities better and more effective. The third part of this strategy is that there will be those cases, specifically in the remote and rural areas, where the cost to transport and the impact upon the veterans' lives outweighs the potential savings of keeping it internal to the VA system. Like all bureaucracies, the VA, having been cut or at least contained over the last decade in terms of the monies they needed to operate their health system, have found unique and interesting ways to control their costs. they have become very miserly about the fee basis system. We are, through all of this task force effort, trying to find ways to force the Congress to have a discussion with the VA about the fact that current transportation systems are inadequate for the capacity that they have, and in fact, current capacity is inadequate. And in this particular case, the common sense rule applies. We are literally having veterans on vans when they can get in the van, driving past very good local health providers on their way to an overbooked major facility. The VA system, its healthcare, once you get it, is superb. But the capacity has been contained and constrained and is not up to where it needs to be. So really, two tracks. We have to make the VA system more effective and larger. Yes. We also, in the meantime, have to take advantage of the resources available in those local areas that will ultimately drive the transportation costs down because they're not transported as often. So that is really why we're asking for your support on HJM 3 to date. It's that third leg of that argument to force the VA to rethink how they're delivering their product.
And for clarity and managing the whole thing, it's the third leg. Can you give me the numbers of the other two? That
Senate 1 and 2?
We can get back to that, but the reason I ask that is
Senate
I want to make this make sense, so we may process
right. Senate,
them in a
Senate Joint Memorial 2 and Senate Joint Memorial 3.
SJM 2 and 3.
SJM 2 has to do with the transportation system, requiring the VA to rethink it. SJM 3 has to do with full funding of all categories of VA.
Okay.
And the HJM 3 is the one before you. We apologize for kind of how they got sprinkled out, but we're grateful for the opportunity to be able to talk to you about it today.
Thank you. We will get back to specific questions, but I want to keep that in mind so that we kind of make
yes,
a
ma'am.
Sensible package out of this. Representative Esquivel, I think you had a question, or have I
completely... Yes, actually I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. There's a kind of a missing piece out here that we really haven't approached, and that is we had a veteran in Medford that had some heart surgery done in Portland, which is fine, but he had an allergic reaction to something and his tongue swelled. He couldn't feed himself, nor could he talk. His tongue was swollen actually out of his mouth. But it took 2 months to get authorization for him to see a specialist, and that's not acceptable. How do we approach that one?
Go ahead. Madam Chair, Representative Esquivel, really by the three memorials we have there, right now the Veterans Administration does not have the staffing levels to be able to work those requests in a timely manner. Now, having said that, I am aware that they are going through some management changes at the VA because of the transition and that there are some different priorities. But really what we have is a situation where there are veterans that are in the system that because there are few, not enough doctors, not enough support to be able to get the care that they need as fast, that people get put off. And one of the things we're arguing for with through this particular measure is that with the fee basis system in place, that would never have been an issue because they'd be utilizing nearby sources. I'd like to tell a story that's similar to yours, sir, that emphasizes the need for this. In Gold Beach, when we were doing the town hall meetings, I got to meet a woman. I'll keep her name quiet because she didn't know that she was signing up for this. But her husband, who had passed away, was a World War II submariner. And he had to make 7 trips in 2 weeks to the Portland VA to get the care. Good care, but 7 trips in 2 weeks would tire anybody when you're driving from Gold Beach up to Portland. And he died in a car accident because of the fog on the coast. We just can do better than that, and that's really what we're trying to get at.
Then there's also another problem. I am a victim of Agent Orange, and I just asked the VA to take care of my medicine. I mean, that isn't asking, I don't think, too much. They would not do that by taking the records of my local physician. They wanted to put me back in the system and bump someone else out of the system and make it more clogged, and that just isn't good common sense. So how do we overcome these things?
Chair, County Representative Esquivel, my argument is that it shouldn't be a choice between. That if you've served your country honorably, which you did, this government should make sure that there's enough doctors and enough system in place to make sure that you don't have to make those choices, whether you're clogging it or not clogging it. Because veterans generally are the kind of folks that will do what you did, not want to get in the way of somebody else.
I turned it down.
That's right. But the bottom line is, you are entitled to that level of service, and especially among combat veterans, access to that system is essential because there are a lot of times hidden things that are all interconnected that if they're in the system already, we can get care quicker and faster and help people. So your comment, sir, is very accurate. There currently are a lot of places where by one person getting in, it makes the system a little bit slower. My answer to that is, if this country is strong enough to wage two wars across the country, we should be damn well strong enough to be able to take care of those that fought the war.
Thank you. Representative Bradley, and then we do have one more individual who'd like to testify on this.
Thank you. Very quickly. Two things. First of all, I know some people who are in the submarine service, and they really react strongly when I say submariner.
Point
that out. The other, but my question was, do we have someone who is ready to take this on?
Chair Cowan, Representative Riley, yes and no. We have a couple of folks that we have identified that have said they want to assist on it. Congressman Walden, Congressman Wu, because of the remote and rural areas in theirs. And this Friday, actually, I'm going to be speaking with Senator Merkley about a number of veterans issues, and he's the one that right now I'm kind of have zeroed in for this because I haven't got him signed up for anything quite yet. But the bottom line is that every part of Oregon that has a remote and rural area really has a stake in this game. So I think it's going to end up with a number of champions, probably Walden more than anybody else in the House, and I think Merkley in the Senate, sir.
Thank you. We won't pin this directly on one until you get that firmed up then, as we have in the past. Thank you, gentlemen.
Madam Chair, as I leave, may I just say to Representative Escobar, when Senate Joint Memorial 3 gets here, that's the one that is specifically designed to deal with the issue that impacted you personally. And you'll recognize it as soon as it arrives because it calls for full funding of the VA healthcare system.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee.
Thank you. Kevin O'Reilly. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly, and I am here representing the Oregon chapter of the Paralyzed Veterans of America, another one of the many nonprofit veteran service organizations. And we will happily support this bill fully. I think it's a measure. It's a good thing, and it's timely. For all the reasons already put forth, it's something that needs to be done. It should have been done, of course, years and years ago. It hasn't been. Hopefully we can make some progress with the new administration. We'll see. And we appreciate the efforts going forth from not only the task force that brought this measure forward, but also from the committee for hearing it and hopefully passing it on. Now, I'm not an expert on these matters, but I believe that fee-based money comes from each service area. So Roseburg has a pot of money that they use to fund their full program, and they have to find fee-based money from that pot. And if they don't have enough money in the pot, they're going to cut back on fee-based services. And that's everything from emergency care, as already mentioned, that type of thing, but it's also things like dental care or podiatry care. So it's simple things that are being left behind. I have trench foot, for instance, and I haven't seen a VA podiatrist in, 15, almost 20 years now, something like that. I go to an outside provider for it because it's easier and got tired of fighting with the VA. Quite frankly, and that's because they don't have a podiatrist to handle it, or their podiatrist is overworked, or I have had to drive down to Roseburg. So for all these various reasons, this is a good thing, and it'll help hopefully move these things along on a national front. And of course, if I can answer any questions, I'll be more than happy to.
Okay. Questions? Thank you for your
Wonderful.
Input. We appreciate you
Thank
being
you.
Here. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on HJM 3, and I think that we're going to plan to kind of hold on to this one and bring it back when we work the two Senate joint memorials that will be headed our way. If we could kind of flag it that way, Mr. Molina.
Yes, ma'am.
That'd be great. The next item on our agenda is HJR 10. I saw Representative Wisden. Is he close by, or?
He'll be returning at 2:15.
I'm sorry. I didn't see the note that you brought me. 2:15. Okay. Let's move down then and briefly open a work session on HJM 5. And this memorial is being heard for the sole purpose of moving it to the House Committee on Rules. Representative Boone?
Madam Chair, I move HJM 5 to be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Thank you. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, could I have the clerk call the roll, please?
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Mr. Dowd?
Aye.
Tom?
Aye.
Riley?
Aye.
Reiter?
Aye.
Friedman?
Aye.
Matthews?
Aye.
Allen?
Aye. This particular issue will be moved to the Committee on Rules, and that's because there are a number of similar kinds of conversations that have been taking place, and because they're related to the Constitution, it's felt that they'd be better to be heard kind of in the same venue. Okay. We'll come back then to HJR 10 and open a public hearing. Mr. Molina.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 10 declares March 2009 American Legion Month.
Thank you. We have Jeff Lightburn and John Kamba, and a third person yet to be named. Please come forward.
Well, HJM 10.
Welcome, gentlemen. Thank you for coming.
Chairwoman Cowan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Lightburn. I'm here on behalf of the American Legion, Department of Oregon. My capacity is chairman of the Public Relations Commission for Department of Oregon. And as you just heard, HJR 10 will recognize the American Legion for its 90th birthday. March 15th through the 17th is the actual dates that marks the 90th birthday of the American Legion, and which, with some 3 million members nationwide, has become our nation's largest veterans service organization. Now, the American Legion, if you go by the dates, look back, it was formed following World War I. And these proud veterans continued to serve even when their successors fought in World War II. Just as every generation of Legionnaires have served their comrades from all wars. But serving fellow veterans is just one of the many ways that the American Legion serves our communities. The American Legion serves our youth through outstanding programs such as American Legion Baseball, Junior Shooting Sports, Boys State, and Boys Nation. You may be familiar with some of these programs. The American Legion has also supported the Boy Scouts since 1919. And today, it charters some 2,800 scouting units comprising of more than 74,000 young men and women across the country. Now, the American Legion Oratorical Contest awards scholarships to young men and women, high schoolers, who can most effectively communicate the ideals of the U.S. Constitution. Now, this should be no surprise, since mentoring youth is one of the key pillars on which the American Legion was founded. And our support has made a difference to the recipients of the Child Welfare Foundation grants, which are used to educate the public about diseases such as juvenile diabetes and autism. Now, we've not forgotten the young people whose parents have made the ultimate sacrifice during the War on Terror. The American Legion's Legacy Scholarship Fund was created to help pay for the college education of those who lost a military parent serving since 9/11. And I believe the amount of money that's been dedicated to this effort in excess of $20 million. The American Legion does these things not because it can, but because it's who we are. Now, our organization has been a driving force behind some of America's greatest legislation, such as securing the passage of the Servicemen's Readjustment Act of 1944, more commonly known as the GI Bill of Rights. But the American Legion hasn't rested on its laurels. And even after that significant and historical accomplishment, we've moved forward. Today, we're still serving and still fighting. We're fighting to increase the power of the GI Bill of Benefits, which have diminished over time. We're fighting for Congress to pass mandatory funding to guarantee that our veterans will receive the best care possible from the VA health care system. And you heard about some of these very specific topics this afternoon. Now, as the war on terrorism continues, more young men and women are coming home bearing the scars of battle. Many continue to recover from severe injuries, including loss of limbs, mobility, and psychological trauma. Through our Hero to Hometowns program, the American Legion works with the Department of Defense to provide these outstanding and dedicated Americans with all the help they need to reestablish their lives when they come home, whether it's walking them home, helping them reintegrate with their families or their communities, resecuring jobs, and so on. Now, another way that the American Legion supports troops is by assisting their families while they're gone. So whether it's mowing a lawn, doing shopping for groceries, the American Legion's Family Support Network stands ready to assist those in need. You know, our national commanders have often spoken about the value of membership. They're not talking about a hotel discounts or the monthly magazine that we all receive or lunch specials at the Legion Post, although those things are fine. The true value of the American Legion membership is displayed every day in communities across Oregon and our nation. It's displayed on the American Legion baseball fields, in a recently renovated VA hospital wing, or at a veterans memorial that was built with American Legion financial support. Here in Oregon, the 25,000 Legionnaires across the state, belonging to 120 posts, along with the 10,000 American Legion auxiliary and Sons of the American Legion members, remain in lockstep with our counterparts across the country, dedicated to service to active military, including our National Guard, veterans, their families, our youth, and our communities. These 35,000 Oregonians are carrying out the programs of national scope that I just briefly touched on a moment ago. Additionally, our Legionnaires like to think outside the box and to improvise in other ways to help their communities. Stevens Shoot Post 4 in Bend, for example, has worked with the Bend Area Habitat for Humanity to enable qualified veteran families to realize the American dream of owning a home. If you're familiar with Habitat for Humanity, this is not a handout, it's a hand up. But it's been a great program to partner and maximize resources on a local level. And there are examples all across the state. So we're not in this for ourselves. We are in this for our brothers and sisters in arms, and we're in this for the husbands, wives, and parents of those who served. As it's been since our founding, the citizens of our great nation and the state of Oregon know when they call, American Legionnaires will continue to say, "At your service." I want to thank you again for hearing us today and sincerely hope that you'll consider approval of HJR 10. I'll be glad to answer any questions. I'll see if my comrades have any further comment.
Would you gentlemen like to identify yourselves for the record and add any comments that you'd like?
Certainly, Madam Chairman. My name is Barry Snyder. I'm the State Adjutant for the American Legion here in Oregon. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer, and really the only reason I'm here is somebody wanted me here in case there were some questions that they felt I'd be more qualified to answer than anybody else. So.
Thank you very much for taking your time to come.
Madam Chairman, my name is John Kalmbach. I'm the Vice Commander for Department of Oregon, and I'm here to second the motion that Jeff just made. Thank you.
Well, again, we appreciate you coming as well. I can't help myself. I have a question. You reference Legionnaires, the Legion Auxiliary, and the Sons of the American Legion. What's the distinction between a Legionnaire and Auxiliary?
Well, Madam Chair, the way to look at it is the American Legion is the principal organization. Those are the veterans, those who served during a wartime period honorably or on active duty. So those are American Legion members.
Okay.
That's the 25,000 that I referred to. There are two other legs of the stool. The American Legion Auxiliary are the ladies, and some spouses, some are sisters, but they are an auxiliary service organization that works lockstep with the Legion. For example, I mentioned Boys State, which is a leadership program for high school juniors. Well, there's a Girls State that mirrors the very same thing that the auxiliary sponsors. There are many programs that the auxiliary sponsors that mirror what we do at the Legion. And the Sons of the American Legion are those folks who have a father, a brother, an uncle, a grandfather that were veterans, but they themselves may not be a veteran, but they wish to serve the organization. So that is what they're involved with.
And as a qualified legionnaire, is that encompasses veterans, both male and female?
Correct.
Great. Thank you. Well, as a graduate of Girls State, I appreciate the efforts of the organization many, many years ago. We're sort of at the point of a song and dance routine, awaiting the good representative if he wishes to add to this. Are there any questions for these gentlemen?
Madam Chair, if I may.
Certainly.
Can you move your chair down? Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jim Willis, Director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. I've never seen myself much as a filler. I hope that's not how you see me now. But I am a life member of the American Legion, and I can tell you firsthand what a great job this organization does, not only in our state, but in our nation. In just less than 2 weeks, I think two of these three people that are here before you will be at our Washington conference. They, along with myself, will be meeting with members of our congressional delegation on these very memorials that you've worked so hard on in this committee and, of course, on the Senate side, some of which have already passed the House floor. And I hope by the time we're there in 10, 15 days, we'll have already passed the Senate side, at least the House measures or the House memorials. So I just want to say on behalf of the men and women of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs how proud we are of the American Legion here in Oregon and all the good work that they do, and their strong support of our organization, because we couldn't get this work done without our fellow veterans. And I urge your strong support of House Joint Resolution 10. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And now I'd like to invite Representative Wisnant, who's joined us. That was an excellent filler. I'm really relieved it wasn't the song and dance routine. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and honorable members of the committee. Thanks for hearing this bill. It's my honor to be the sponsor of it. It was not my idea. As most of us know, our good ideas come from our constituents. But it is an honor. I've been an American Legion member. My membership has expired.
oh, my goodness.
But
that's on the record.
You're going to hear that about the great American Legion across Oregon and all they do for our veterans and our communities, and hope you'll expeditiously approve this resolution and pass it on so we can honor these men and their auxiliaries for all the work that they do for our veterans and stuff. So that's all I had. Question.
Thank you very much. Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to thank the representative for reminding me I need to go pay my dues.
Well, I see that this has been a day of enlightenment for many. Thank you for bringing this to us, and we do recognize that February is moving along, and this is aimed at the month of March. So I think with that, I will close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 10 and open a work session on HJR 10. Representative Esquivel.
Yes, Madam Chair, I recommend that we move HJR 10 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any further discussion? Could we have the clerk call the roll, please?
Aye.
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 Riley.
Aye.
Major.
Aye.
Freeman.
Aye.
Matthews.
Aye.
Aye. HJR 10 is unanimously passed, and I think that we should allow Representative Wisnett to carry this for us. We will share that with him. Thank you again, gentlemen, for coming. We appreciate it very much, and we appreciate you bringing it to his attention.
I hope he pays his dues before he carries
it. I think you should make sure that that gets taken care of.
You've already done that, man.
All righty. Okay. Thank you. With that, if I haven't officially closed that work session, I just did. Committee, I would recommend that you make sure you take note of the fact there's been a revision in the agenda for February 19th. This Thursday, we had some technical difficulties, so the list of bills that we'll be hearing are a little different than what we had planned to. So you might make sure you're looking at the right agenda. With that, seeing nothing else, we are adjourned.